fall. Baby, it's not our chance. We're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Well, we've got one of the best, finest guest we've ever had on our program over the years, and he's out of United Kingdom. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling. We're still brothers in battle, and so to speak. And tell our listening audience a little bit of your background, so they'll if the people haven't heard you before, will understand who you are and where you're coming from.
Well, I come from an aviation family, which was in general aviation in Britain, you know, kind of supplying bits and pieces for aircraft all over the country, actually. Mainly light aircraft, some sort of business aircraft, that sort of thing. And I suppose in a way that you know, once you've flown in one airplane, seen one airplane, another one, you know, after a while it becomes a little bit dull. And I was more interested in the challenge of journalism. So I started working in community radio in London and then got a job in the BBC. This is in one of the main newsrooms in London, actually, radio newsrooms, which was a real buzzing atmosphere in Marylebone High Street, where we were chasing the other radio stations in London to be the first to the news all the time. So I worked there for about three and a half years, started as a researcher, eventually ended up as a reporter and a journalist. And then my contract came to an end, but I got into environmental campaigning. So I was doing land occupations, organising mass trespasses in the 1990s, and really making sure that there was some kind of activity in the country where the terrible anomaly in the number of people who actually own land was challenged. I mean, you know, we've got something like 60 million acres of land here in Britain and about the same number of people, and yet we've got probably half the population, roughly half the population, completely landless. That is to say that they are having to rent or else they're homeless. I mean, we've got something like 200,000 people officially homeless in Britain. That is to say that they're either sleeping on the streets or they're in very overcrowded accommodation, and this is almost the hidden scandal of the country, and the reason for that is because the powers that be, the City of London, these kind of people, like to keep people homeless, I'm afraid. That's the way it is, because then they are keen workers, and they will go and work in those dark satanic mills if this basic human right of somewhere to stay, somewhere to live, is taken away from them. So, yes, I went into environmental campaigning, and then when I moved to Bristol, I started doing a bit of work on the radio again, in community radio. For the last 3.5 years, I've been doing a politics program every week with the councillors and the MPs from around here, plus we do investigative journalism, because that's what I really love. And one of the things that we've found out over the last couple of years has been really pursuing the end game of World War II, really looking at some of the traitors there were within the system, deconstructing the Battle of Arnhem, the Bridge Too Far battle, and finding that it seems that there was some really serious traitorous activity going on within the Allied side, particularly the British, not so much the Americans, actually trying to extend the war so that Hitler's troops could actually get some of the looted wealth from Europe out of Germany and screw it away around the world in order to form a kind of post-war Odessa Fourth Reich empire. That is to say, with the Nazis taking off their swastikas and marching into the boardrooms of the world and taking over countries using money rather than tanks. So in a nutshell, that's where I'm coming from, George.
Right. If you could back off your mic just a little bit, it would be helpful. But I'll tell you what, you really had a tremendous background and experience, and consistently I've noticed in your postings and your own radio program there in Bristol, you're on the leading edge of what's happening in England, and much of the time what happens there happens here later. Well, is that true or accurate statement from me?
I would say sometimes both ways round. I mean, we look at what's happening here. For example, we have just had over the last year, police commissioners for the first time electing people to look after our police budgets. Now, this is really a policy transplanted from the United States. And also, for example, with the Syria debacle a couple of months ago, that seems to be not
right
so
there,
much
yeah.
led by Britain, but by the US. So in a way, you know, sometimes Britain follows the US. There's certainly a lot of interlocking of transatlantic business organisations, and quite clearly the Bilderberg organisation is quite key in a lot of this, the Royal Institute for International Affairs and the Council on Foreign Relations too, you know, making sure that the business community is basically running the government, the people and the elected representatives hardly get a look in.
Right. These interlocking, you know what I mean, like the Council on Foreign Relations and the Royal Institute of International Affairs were created at the same time by the same people, were they not?
Yes, that's correct. And, you know, it really a little bit came out of the British Empire and Cecil Rhodes in Rhodesia and South Africa and in Africa's part of the African colonies. I mean, we've had quite a shock last week, although it was reported very little here in Britain, and that is that the Gambia has decided to leave the Commonwealth. A lot of the news people here seem to be saying, well, who cares if Gambia leaves the Commonwealth? Well, isn't that an interesting attitude? If the Commonwealth, it doesn't matter if African colonial nations decide that Britain has not stopped being a colonial nation, and therefore they want nothing more to do with it. I mean, we're having the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Sri Lanka next month, where I don't think the Queen is going, but I think Prince Charles is going instead of him. Well, Sri Lanka has got the most, at the moment, human rights abusing regime anywhere in the world, where 40,000 Tamils were slaughtered by the Sinhalese majority army. I mean, this is civilians being slaughtered by an army. Back in 2009, really nothing has been done to correct that. The guy, I think the Rajapaksa was his name, the Prime Minister, is still in charge, and yet the British decide that it's going to be okay to go and hold a Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting with him, I suppose, providing the drinks. And this is just simply a repeat of the former bad old days of colonialism, that Britain seems to be continuing down that same road.
Right. Boy, I tell you what, that... Some of this, you have so much knowledge on these things. Do you read profusely, I mean, all the time, or how do you keep up on all this?
Well, I mean, I do. You have to read a lot doing a weekly politics program, and I do try and keep up. But, I mean, I think there are several websites that I get a lot of information from, which I find particularly useful. I mean, I've found the Press TV, which is the Iranian channel's news, actually really interesting, particularly on what's going on in the Middle East, deconstructing this stuff. I'm not interested in what the governments want us to think or what the state broadcasters or private broadcasters want us to think, because they are getting more and more biased in the Western world and more concentrated into fewer hands. And so, you know, you can't necessarily rely on them. I found, for example, the analysis by Press TV of what's going on in Iraq, the horrendous slaughter that Tony Blair and George Bush have left this disgusting situation in the wake of the invasion in 2003, where there are now hundreds of people a week dying through these apparently random bomb attacks that are going on. Well, it's interesting to read that actually it looks like the Saudi Arabians are behind this, and the Saudi Arabians are meeting with Israelis, and the Saudi Arabians are very best friends with David Cameron, and so it looks like we've got a really rogue state, the Saudis, who are actually a terrorist state. The funny thing is we haven't touched them. But NATO has gone into the other countries in the Middle East and done all sorts of dirty work there, like Libya and attempting to do in Syria. And so there's lots of sort of reverse morality. The better your regime is, the more likely we are to attack you. If you're corrupt, we'll leave you alone. So what does that say about where the West is heading? I mean, it says quite a lot to me about us, really, I suppose, throwing off any kind of moral certitude that we had after the end of World War II, having beaten the Nazis. And it's almost like we're taking on now the mantle of some kind of new world order to sort of move our ideas, our ownership into these other countries.
Right.
The Germans and the Israelis are attempting to sort of stand off and away from the fight, but obviously being very much involved in the, behind the scenes. I mean, we had also the attack by the Israelis on Syria, an attempt to get a war started by firing a couple of missiles. So, you know, all sorts of interesting stuff going on, but the way to keep around it, I would suggest a couple of websites particularly. One is the globalresearch.ca. The Canadian site, which I use quite a bit, and the other is the Iranian News. I mean, we've had that now banned here in Britain on the what they call Freeview here, which is the digital channels, by the regulators, even though our own TV channels are telling us lies. Day after day, we had a thing with the BBC just recently where the testimony of a woman doctor who was around at the scene of the chemical weapons attack that it seemed to be anyway in Damascus, or just on the outskirts of Damascus, her testimony was actually edited by the BBC, and the only reason they were able to do that was because she was wearing a face mask, and so anybody watching it would not be able to tell that her words had been edited. What was edited out was the word that she thought it was napalm, and what was edited in was that she thought it was chemical weapons. So absolutely appalling behaviour by our mainstream press and by our bankers, who I think actually between them are the real crooks in all this, George, the banking financial sector and the mainstream press.
My gosh. What's the situation there in Syria? They're trying to dispose of those chemical weapons now. Is that the process undergoing right now? In Syria.
Well, it's very, very interesting to see how this all plays out because, of course, the Israelis are the biggest threat to, the closest threat to the Syrians, and they still have their nuclear weapons. So I would actually be quite surprised if Assad truly gave up his chemical weapons and left the Israelis with their nukes because, you know, that would just simply be leaving an opening for the Israelis to invade the Golan Heights and take over Syria, which is, I would imagine, not what he wants.
Right. You know, President Obama's called these scandals that have cropped up in this country phony scandals. What would be your comment?
Well, I don't know. Which scandals are you talking about particularly?
Well, he's calling all of them phony scandals, you know? I mean, just, you know, he's using a blanket term, and he's calling that these scandals that have come up, Benghazi, IRS, and all that, is phony scandals. That false, you know, scandals. Now, I mean,
well, that's quite possible, and of course the mainstream media is very, very good at focusing us on things that don't actually matter. I mean, for example, the default, I don't think it's very likely for the default to really happen. I mean, all the time, but I mean, you have to look at the banks who've lent the money. I mean, are they likely to actually agree to some sort of default? No, they're going to just try and roll the loans over, and they're going to continue to do that and continue to do that, but of course, banks are really like gangsters. You know, they will threaten and bully, and this is exactly what I think they're doing, George, just threatening and bullying and cajoling. Because, I mean, we really do have, I mean, this is the old thing, the creature from Jekyll Island, you know. This is really what's happened, is we've lost control, the people I'm talking about, you know, American people, British people, European people have lost control of their media. In other words, they've lost access to it, and they've lost honesty into the people who are running it. And the other thing they've lost control of course, is the money system, the financial system. There are a tremendous amount of people who are doing absolutely nothing to contribute to our society, but they happen to be wealthy and are just living off the backs of everybody else. And we're starting to see society dividing. It's almost like a cell dividing into the people who are poor but honest and the people who are rich but, greedy.
Yeah, the only point I was trying to make, Tony, was that our president's calling the scandals that have occurred recently in the last 6-8 months are real scandals. He's trying to put the word phony on them, and that's just a big, you know, bending of the truth, you know?
Well, is it who you mean talking about? Are you talking about Syria, for example? Because, I mean, there's a lot of scandals around. Well, some I think are real, some aren't.
Yeah, I'm talking about Benghazi, the IRS, the news scandal, the investigation of our news people, and all these other scandals. They're real scandals. He uses the word phony to pass it off to the American public. It's some kind of neuro-linguistic programming gimmicks that they use all the time, you know?
The main purpose of a president or a prime minister nowadays is simply to have access to the news media to tell lies. I mean, that is essentially what we've come to. It's not very much truth out of the mouths of our leaders. I mean, we do have a bit here in Britain with the Labour opposition leader, Ed Miliband. I mean, he's recently come out and said, well, we need to freeze energy prices for 2 years. The trouble, of course, is that this is easy to get around for the big energy companies. They just put the price up just before Ed Miliband says there's going to be a freeze. And so, in a way, even the opposition are coming up with ideas which sound good on the surface, but if as soon as you start to scratch at them, you realise, well, this is really a little bit of a two-dimensional idea. Where is it going to go? The people need to get back control of their governments, because every time they privatise, we've just had the Royal Mail privatised here in Britain today, with £100 or so robbed from every single family in Britain because it was undervalued. Every time that happens, our votes mean less and less and less. And what's happening is, even only every 5 years, what's beginning to happen now is that it's just a simple charade, because the politicians don't actually control anything anymore, because the people that really control things are the financiers and the City of London and Wall Street. And increasingly, I'm afraid to say, people like Deutsche Bank and the European Central Bank, there's many people now pointing their fingers at Germany and saying, actually, what you're doing, Germany, is you're waging economic warfare on Europe, and we don't like it, and we think that actually you should stop, because we don't want to reawaken any of those old wounds.
Right. You know what the Germans couldn't do in combat, they're doing financially in Europe, are trying to, aren't they?
Well, they're not trying to. They are doing it. Most people in Greece now.
They couldn't win on the battlefield, but they're winning on the business and the financial battlefield, are they not?
Well, I wouldn't go so bold as to say that, because many of the battlefields they did win. I mean, they were very, very technologically advanced in the late 1930s, in the end,
they didn't win the war. You know,
they were going to. You know, I think maybe, you know, even people that thought, surely Hitler's not going to do this because he can't win. And, of course, they were right. But yes, you're absolutely right. But what's happening now is psychological warfare, Goebbels style, and it's financial warfare from Deutsche Bank and from the European Central Bank, the Bank for International Settlements, which incidentally was set up after World War One to administer the war reparations for World War One, and it was one of the things that dragged Nazi Germany down, or actually dragged Germany down after the war so bad that they thought that they would embrace somebody like Hitler. Now, this is the thing that worries me, George, about what's going on in the West, is when things start getting really bad for us, when people are losing their homes, when people have no income, they have all sorts of problems with even getting their children educated, getting food on the table, then they start to be susceptible to this sort of Hitler, what I'd call the Hitler syndrome, where any kind of leader that comes along that looks like they can sort things out, they welcome them with open arms. So it's almost like it's rolling out a red carpet for the next Hitler. That's what bothers me, George.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. Is that and people that are starving, and they want answers, and they always fall victim to these cults of personality, you know. All of these very statist governments have these big portraits of their great leaders, right, up on big billboards and so forth, you know. And they're always looking
at
the people.
In order for that to work,
you've
got to have some kind of real oppression going on for people to find someone to look up to like that. I don't know if that's really going to be the way here in Britain, though, because I think we're a little bit more sophisticated than a nation that would, behave like that. I can't see it happening like that here. I think, in a lot of ways, Britain is at the epicenter of a lot of this, and it's funny, isn't it, how we had our empire, the biggest empire the world's ever seen, which I think is High Point, if you can call it that.
What year do you think Britain, Great Britain, reached its really pinnacle of success.
I think it was about 1922 when something like a third or a quarter of the land surface of the earth was controlled from London.
Okay.
But, you know, this is the trouble is all these things, like Rome, isn't it? And, of course, you know, our Britannia is, of course, a Roman goddess. Actually, you know, it's nothing to do with, you know, anything to do with Britain. It's just it's a kind of mock Roman Empire that they're trying to create, I think, where the leaders, whoever they are behind the scenes, the people that pull the strings, actually do think of themselves as gods because they can get away with so much in secret. They're not in public. The journalists can't see them. It's very difficult to commentate on people who you can't see. And these are the people who are really controlling things from behind the scenes. They're very secretive. And as I said earlier on, you know, organisations like the Council on Foreign Relations, Royal Institute for International Affairs, these kinds of massive, essentially they're kind of cartels of lots of different industries that are all pushing for similar types of foreign policy, and they want to basically control the government. The fact of the matter is, they are now far better funded than the government itself, and so they have actually had the whip hand over our elected representatives.
What did you think about the book Towers of Babel? What did you think about that book?
Oh, The Tower of Babel. It's brilliant. I mean, you know, Adam Labore has chosen a fantastic time to write this book about the Bank for International Settlements. Really important. I mean, it's been out a few months now, but at least we're starting to understand how it operates. And this is at the core of the international financial system. Representatives from all the major central banks are in there, as well as these bigger currencies like the euro, the EU currency. And there is, it's almost as if, I mean, the way things are happening nowadays is as if things aren't even being announced. I mean, we've got, for example, incredible technologies coming into schools here in Britain. I mean, we've had actually our local authority here in Bristol, the council has completely banned it, but it's happening in different parts of the country where children are fingerprinted, having iris scans, and palm prints, this kind of thing, biometric data taken, so that they can do things like get their school lunch or borrow books from the library. We're also having the use of these RFID chips, tiny little chips in your like the ones you get in your credit card or your debit card. These things also being used in order to track children around schools. Now, what very few people realise is that actually NATO has its own chip tracking system. So when those children leave the school, unbeknownst to them, they're also being tracked around their local town, their village, their port, their airport, or whatever, by NATO. And this technology is coming in without any kind of public discussion, any kind of public debate. It's essentially a technocracy where he who controls the passwords to the technology and controls the ownership of it, in other words, whether you're actually allowed to, not allowed to discuss it, but know about it.
Is that the mark of the beast?
Very, very, very secret.
That's
what's happening. It's being endorsed through the children, and they're being persuaded to take this technology on, thinking it's very exciting. The adults are completely wrong-footed by it because they don't see the technology. I mean, you know, a lot of the time the kids just do it without even telling their adults. But where it's happened, it has been pointed out, there has been some sort of legislation to try and slow it down and stop it. But this is incredibly stealthy. It's coming in without people realizing it's even happening.
Doesn't the Bible say buying and selling the mark of the beast or something? Is this just a version of it, you think, or technique?
Well, I think certainly microchips, they have this thing called the very chip, don't they, which is probably injectable into a human being. I think once they get to the stage where they're saying to the kids, oh, you've swapped that over too many times, you know, you've used somebody else's chip or whatever to get into the school, and they'll start trying to persuade youngsters to have these chips. It's already perfectly normal, it seems, with animals.
Oh, you got to have the chip.
This is, I think, the technology that they're using is a sort of Trojan horse to drive this into the human population. And, of course, the more chaos that can be caused at the time this is happening, the better from an evil person's point of view, you know, from the point of view of someone that wants to get this technology in. If they can create social chaos at the same time, then it's very, very difficult for society to actually argue against it. Journalists, writers, free thinkers can't be organised against it when it's happening in a time of chaos, which is the sort of time we're going into now with the financial system the way it is.
Right. What is this about military privatization of the procurement programs in Great Britain? Is that underway now, or what's happening?
Well, this is an incredible thing, George. I mean, it's so Orwellian, it's unbelievable. It really is George, straight out of George Orwell. The idea that the private military companies can actually be in charge of the process to procure military equipment is a pretty scary one. And I was chatting to a journalist from The Independent today, from London, which is The Independent on Sunday, Evening Standard is one newspaper empire based in London here in Britain. Well, it's not that big an empire. In fact, it's probably the most balanced newspaper you'll find in Britain at the moment. And he was explaining to me how even from the Pentagon, they've been throwing up their hands in exasperation. What are you doing, England? Because they are actually preparing to privatise that whole process of procurement, to allow companies like Bechtel, possibly BAE Systems, big defence manufacturer, to actually own and run the procurement process. Now, I don't know about you, George, but this just sounds totally bonkers to me. I mean, they're going to award by themselves these contracts. There's going to be some way to do it, but I mean, it just sounds like the most crazy idea. What they're trying to do, and this is actually playing into the hands, of course, of the fascists that want to completely strip the state of anything, is they're actually stripping down the government until there's nothing left and the vote means nothing. Now, that is the kind of world we're moving towards. And even in this particular system, you have to ask yourself, don't you, why are we paying taxes if the government hardly exists anymore? It's been stripped down to the bone.
Right. Were these public-private partnerships initiated under Thatcher, or did they precede her?
Well, I think it may be just after Thatcher or around about the time of Thatcher. I mean, I don't like them at all. Very, very bad idea. What you're allowing is big defence companies to come into the Ministry of Defence. Just a crazy concept, a silly thing to do. But, you know, there are all sorts of methods. But, you know, if you've got money, you can basically bribe your way into almost anywhere. And what they've done is they seem to have managed to bribe their way right into the centre of our government. The government is no longer really interested in the people. It doesn't want to vote. It's just interested in the people in the top of the government. Anyway, the millionaires in the cabinet are simply looking at the jobs that they're going to be offered when they leave government. So they are really not interested at all in what ordinary people want. In fact, anybody except the people who are about to give them lots of money when they leave office. I mean, look at Tony Blair, for example, jetting himself all around the world. Even though the guy's a war criminal, he thinks, anyway, in his rather strange fashion, that he walks on water. You know, he's getting these special deals to go and do talks all over the place. He's making pronouncements about Syria, saying that we should send missiles into Damascus. I mean, nobody really takes the guy in the least bit serious anymore. He's actually a criminal, and yet he is strutting around on the world stage. What we're ending up with, George, both in the United States and here in Britain, is a kind of Mubarak syndrome, where you've got somebody you've got leaders and you've got political people who are so corrupt, they've done so many corrupt and crooked deals, that they will fight and fight to stay in their positions, and they're spending much, much too much of their time fighting any opposition and trying to cope with the fact that they're crooked, rather than even doing their job. So we've got effectively a kind of rudderless ship. And while the ship's rudderless, it's like a kind of fire sale or car boot sale where anybody can come up and buy things, take things, and that's what's happening in the world right now. I mean, you can see some countries are worse off than others, like Greece, for example. Portugal's going through a terrible, terrible time. But this is simply as bad as actually a world war. What Mervyn King said, the Bank of England governor, the outgoing one, before this guy came from the Nazi bank, BIS, is that actually what we've gone through since 2008 is the equivalent of World War II in economic terms. The thing is, what have we actually achieved? We've achieved absolutely nothing except for loads and loads of suffering and some boost to the richer what people in the society are doing really rather nicely out of it.
Right. You know, the Bank of International Settlements, the recent book just published on October 1 of this year, written by Stephen Kinzer, entitled The Brothers. I interviewed him last weekend for one full hour. And he describes John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles in very, very objective terms, and neither one looks very good.
Well, no, that's because there were lots of deals done at the end of the Second World War. I mean, I've just been looking recently at a particular deal, which was the kidnapping of Hitler's secretary Martin Bormann out from Berlin by a very special unit of MI6, M section, and involved in that there was James Bond. Well, we call him James Bond, don't we? He's the guy that wrote the James Bond books, and the operation was called James Bond. What he was doing, this is Ian Fleming, when he was writing those books about James Bond, he was leaving a little clue in the title, because if you then go through the British Security Service records and have a look for something called Operation James Bond, you will find some very, very interesting things were going on at the end of World War II, as Bormann was helped to escape by the British in order to go and then, I mean, what the people who were actually involved in the operation were told that this was really important because they wanted to get the wealth of Nazi Germany and they wanted to use it for good purposes at the end of the Second World War. Now, of course, they never actually did that. I mean, they just basically allowed Bormann with some other crooked people from the Western world, from the United States and from Great Britain, France, obviously Germany, and that operation was conducted in extreme secrecy. So you had Ian Fleming involved in it. You also had Desmond Morton. And the interesting thing about Desmond Morton is he was very close friends with Winston Churchill. In fact, Desmond Morton bought his house in rural Kent, very, very close to Chartwell, where Winston Churchill lived, actually before Churchill. So if you're looking at the historical record, it looks like Churchill bought his home in order to be close to Morton rather than the other way around, because Churchill moved close to Morton. Now, Morton was a single man, but he was involved very much in this. He was working for MI6. He was actually also an aide-de-camp to General Haig in World War I. And then he worked with Churchill in the interwar years. But you know, he is a very, very strange character, because I was just chatting with a woman called Jill Bennett, who's the former chief historian of the Foreign Office last week, and she explained to me, and this was an absolute bombshell, although I was interested in Morton, I didn't know he was doing this, but Morton was Britain's representative on the tripartite Nazi Gold Committee after World War II. So he was in a perfect position to actually cover up his nefarious activities through getting Martin Bormann out and the Nazi Gold, controlling the Nazi Gold and what happened to that. He was sitting on the committee that was supposed to be finding out what had happened to it, where he knew all along that he had been up to no good and doing bad things with it. So fascinating to see that these little connections all match up. Someone who was very, very close friends with, not only with Winston Churchill himself, but also with the King, George VI, who of course had a brother who was himself an unrepentant Nazi, Edward VIII, who had to abdicate because he was such an enthusiastic Nazi. It seems there were quite a lot in the British establishment who admired the Nazis rather too much. So, you know, it's not surprising that a lot of people in this country really are cynical and were during the end of the Second World War and voted in the socialist government, because they could see that a lot of the establishment was rather too close to the Nazis. And in fact, some parts of that establishment clearly did very, very well out of World War II and bought into this new Nazi empire. And even though it was very secret, it still brought them a fantastic living. I'm talking about some of the bigger organisations, food companies, these kind of things now, which seem to be being run in a very, shall we say, aggressive fascist style, like monopolies, basically taking over countries, cities, towns, factories, this kind of thing, in almost like a similar way to an army. And, of course, we've got hardly any real borders anymore. People can go backwards and forwards between these various borders, and the idea is free flow of labour. And so what that means is if cash can flow in and out of your country easily with no problem, if people can flow in and out of your country easily without a problem, you don't really have a country anymore, because anything that's of value there can just leave at a whim. I think that we are heading towards this whole sort of European Union, a Bilderberg country, NATO. It's almost like NATO is an army for its own country, and slowly but surely the individual forces, the individual countries are slowly dissolving into one.
Right. NATO is a tremendously expanding, are they not? And they're trying to do a step out, you know, out past their normal borders. It started to be the National Atlantic Treaty Organization, but it's more than that now, is it not?
Well, it's much, much more. Paul Hauser, he was an SS, in commander of an SS Panzer Corps at the end of World War II. He's quoted as saying that NATO was formed, the first meetings, formed from international supporters of the SS. Now, that's a pretty shocking thing to come out of the mouth of a senior SS officer at the end of the war. When he saw first NATO meetings, that's what he said. And I don't think he was joking. I think there was quite a lot of people of sympathy with the Nazis. It's quite clear. At the end of the war, we were quite happy to do deals with these guys because we saw the next war as being with the Russians. We saw it as possibly being a nuclear war, which we hoped we could win, because we had more technology at the time than the Russians did. This, I think, is barely acknowledged in the West. The amount of dodgy deals that went on at the end of World War II between us and the Nazis. So, that's, I suppose, Desmond Morton is what I've looked into here in Britain, and the specific individuals around the leaders of the country. As for what actually happens on the ground, we're starting to see again now the same kind of thing that was in the run-up to World War II. What they call austerity, which means people having to have food handouts, this kind of thing is all beginning now. Even people who've got full-time jobs are finding it impossible to pay the bills and the rent and put the food on the table. It's exactly what was happening in the run-up to the Second World War. The other thing we're seeing, of course, is the racist street fighting. I don't know if you've had much of that in the United States. But here in Britain, it started up with the marches by something called the English Defence League, which is working very, very closely with Zionist organisations. In fact, sometimes you see Zionist Israeli flags at these EDL demonstrations. And, of course, we had a similar thing in London in the run-up to World War II. We had Oswald Mosley, who was a Conservative MP for a while, and then became started something called the British Union of Fascists, and they were doing welling street battles in the East End of London. They were particularly racist, but then they were also into Hitler's idea of a kind of master race, and if we can only just discipline people and tell them how to behave, then the society will work better. Well, obviously it doesn't work better, but this is the kind of thing we're starting to see now. So in a way, I think we should be very, very wary that this is the birth pangs of possibly, a wider war. Obviously we've seen in Syria an attempt to get that going. And I would suggest everybody should be on the lookout for another 9/11 style attack. Large false flag attack, which is actually blamed on a country that the West is trying to invade, or Israel is trying to invade. That's the kind of thing. In fact, we even had Britain's Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, this week come out and say, we will not involve in any other foreign wars unless there is another 9/11. He actually said that this week, George.
My gosh. Why don't you expand on those thoughts a little bit then?
This is Sir Peter Tapsell we're talking about, the father of the house. What he's essentially been saying is that, why are we staring into this Armageddon option? What he's doing in a rather cheeky way is pointing out that some of these interventions are not going to work. This is a military decision that's quite obviously happened to do with Syria. It's all very well kicking Mr. Gaddafi around because he hasn't got a lot of allies and he didn't have a big international power supporting him. But Syria is a very, very different story. And so what he said was that this was, why would Mr. Cameron take the Armageddon option? And what would he do if the Americans illegally attacked Syria and the Russians quite legally moved in to defend them? Because then you'd have a potential world war on your hands. In a way, what he's saying is, if such a war was to happen, David, which side would you be on? And making it very, very clear that the rule of law side is actually the Russian side, and the American side in such a case would be totally illegal. And a very interesting to see that sort of discussion being made in the House of Commons. One of the first, certainly the first time I've heard that sort of language, you know, the Armageddon option being used.
Right, right. Oh, gosh, that is interesting. In addition, the Syrian thing seems to be settling down. Otherwise, what do you think? Are they going to get the chemical weapons out of there or not?
Difficult to know, George. Just don't know. I think a lot of this stuff, you can't really predict it. I would suggest that there will not be a complete moratorium on weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East unless all of the weapons of mass destruction go. You can't have the Israelis with their 200 nuclear weapons and then expect everybody else to get rid of their weapons of mass destruction. I'm afraid it's just not going to work because nobody trusts Netanyahu. Everybody knows that what he really wants is to get his hands on all that land around Israel. They're an expansionist nation. They want to expand. They're already expanding, you know, within their own borders, even though those borders, you know, it's probably the least country in the world which has got at least certain borders. They're corralling in a racist apartheid manner the Palestinian people and expanding their own territories within their own place. So, you know, nobody really trusts them. Everybody knows that the Israelis are up to all sorts of dirty tricks, I mean, particularly in dealing with the Saudi Arabians and fomenting terror in other parts of the Middle East. I say everybody knows that. I mean, certainly a lot of the mainstream media don't cover this stuff, but anybody that bothers to look at what's really going on will see that. So, I'm afraid I can't look into my crystal ball, George, to tell you what's going to happen with Syria, only that this certainly does seem to be echoing of almost biblical proportions because, of course, Paul had his conversion, Saul had his conversion on the road to Damascus. And, you know, Damascus is a very, very important city, both in spiritual and biblical terms and in the modern world and in, you know, strategic and military terms for the world's armed forces. For the U.S. Pentagon, that will be looking at Damascus and saying, maybe we better not go there.
Yeah, you know, that's very interesting. That it is a center of a lot of conflict over the ages, over the centuries. The Middle East is being balkanized, it looks like. I mean, big time. And one thing I've noticed is that I've never seen the Saudis this aggressive and this, partisan. Have you ever seen them being this partisan and this aggressive?
Well, I think they have been for a long, long time. I think the leaders, for example, have been seduced by pornography. You know, they're supposed to be Islamic. And, I mean, we saw in the 1970s and 80s loads of these Saudi sheikhs coming over to London and finding, oh, isn't it nice I can have a few girls over here? You know, that, I'm afraid, is being partly their downfall, the idea that they fall in love with a lot of these, Western entrapments like wealth and these kinds of things that were actually traditionally not the way in the Middle East. You know, whatever you might say about Gaddafi, he lived a relatively simple lifestyle. When he turned up for a diplomatic meeting, he used to live in his tent. And he was actually much closer than many people realize to being one of the sort of traditional Bedouin-type characters that traditionally inhabited the Middle East. So the Saudis are well beyond that. They've got a very, very strange cult-like version of Islam. Rather like maybe the Christian Zionist cults have got strange organizations that seem to not actually understand the message of Christ at all. In a similar way, I don't think that the Saudi rulers have got really very much contact with the message of Muhammad at all. In fact, the thing is, there's nothing new about this. You go back to medieval times and you'll find on both sides of the religious divide during the Crusades that there were organizations, there were churches, there were individuals who had fake versions of these various religions. Obviously, the most obvious is the Christian Templars, going around massacring, killing people because they didn't have the same faith. Well, did Jesus do that? I didn't see him doing that. Were they following his example? No, of course they're not. But what they were doing was they were looting, pillaging, raping, and plundering but they were using Jesus as a convenient sort of strap line or cover for their nefarious activities. And, of course, this is exactly what the Saudi government are doing today, the Saudi leaders are doing today, is they're using Islam as a convenient veil for their own greed and profligacy. And we are actually colluding with them in a lot of ways. So I think what's happening is that there is a sort of it's the sheep and the goats, George. You know, some of the real people are showing themselves out to be honest, decent, real people, and this is not something that we see on the news necessarily, or anything on the TV, or even here on the radio. But in amongst people's ordinary circles, they will start to see some people here are honest, decent, and have the spirit of self-sacrifice, and are in touch in some way with the spiritual. Others are almost dead to those around them and only looking after their own interests. And we're starting to see a bit of a shakedown, I think, right across the Western world, particularly, and also in the Middle East, of the way that these, you know, these people operate. And they're starting to separate out the people who are honest from those who are dishonest. And I think that's one of the side effects of all this greed that's happened in the West, the attempt to take over countries, and, of course, the greed of the super rich. So you've got a war which weighs also on the domestic populations, of course.
Right. Is it that money system that has corrupted everything? A mammon, the Bible would say. You can only have one God before you, mammon or God, and have they chosen mammon to worship? Is that it?
Well, I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, the William Cooper, you know, your William Cooper, I don't know if you followed his work much, but, I mean, he was very, very clear about this. These people think that they are gods. They don't actually, you know, they may be satanic or Luciferian. It's possible, I suppose, but I don't think that's even necessary. What these secret societies do is that they actually get people to think, well, you are a god. There's something very Nietzschean about this, you know, man and Superman, you are a god, and the idea is that you are all-powerful as a specific individual, and an ordinary man can be God. Well, I mean, this is just complete rubbish and poppycock, but when it gets into somebody's head that they are, then they start to become rather incredibly egotistical, and then they're snapped up by some of the more powerful people in society in the knowledge that they will do anything. They will stop at nothing, because they actually think, a little bit like the Nazis and their idea of the Übermensch and the Untermensch, you know, that they are actually better than everybody else, and they lose any kind of sympathy with the poor and the people that really need their help. So it's a form of tyranny, and in a way, human society regularly seems to throw up these things, George. You know, it seems to throw up corrupt leaders who have a lust for power. They get together, they organize to take over power, and then there's a big shakedown, and the cycle starts all over again. But the thing is that they're actually very, very well organized, and they spend a lot of money on making sure that they can control what we see and feel and think, and they're doing a lot of work, I think, on psychological warfare,
sure,
basically to make us think that there's nothing wrong, that everything's fine, just chug along and everything will be fine. But as Bill Cooper said, George, I think on one of the talks that he said, you know, everybody has to be aware, they really must wake up, or they will be enslaved. And I think I absolutely agree with that. You know, we just need to be a little bit conscious.
True. You know, Stephen Kinzer, in my interview last week, took the design of the Council on Foreign Relations, there, the one in New York, and deciphered the Latin that is in that design, and he came up with all over, Latin for all over. And I said, what? That sounds like Uber Allis, doesn't it? You know what
well,
I mean?
Maybe
but within that, symbol, that logo that the Council on Foreign Relations is using in New York, it says all over in Latin.
Well, listen, we had it in Bristol, you know, I'm talking to you from the city of Bristol in
sure.
the west of England. It was from here that John Cabot set off to discover so-called America, even though, of course, there were plenty of people over there to begin with.
Sure.
You know, that's where his ship set off from. And he became, after he came back, he was made the master of something called the Merchant Venturers. The Merchant Venturers was a very rich, very wealthy organization based here in Bristol. After a while, it became so powerful that the king had to intervene and close it down because of the monopolistic practices it was using. It was charging ships, all the ships that came in and out of Bristol had to pay money to the merchant venturers. And, of course, they had all the maps. They were compiling maps of all sorts of resources around the world that nobody else was allowed to know about. A very powerful organisation. Anyway, they were closed down, and then they restarted again, calling themselves the Merchant Venturers. They started as the Merchant Adventurers with Cabot. And there's still a lot of memory of that around. And, of course, this was the organisation that organised the triangular trade, where millions of poor, helpless black people in Africa were rounded up, sometimes by black people as well, and taken on these slave ships over to the Caribbean. That was all organised from both the city of Bristol by the merchant venturers and also from the city of Liverpool. The triangular trade, particularly bad because none of the slaves ever actually came to Bristol. The ships would set off from here down to Africa and then take the slaves across and then come back to Bristol with sugar from the plantations. So the slaves themselves were traded, but the people of Bristol were not troubled by actually seeing the blood and the terror that was involved in that whole process. Now, that organisation still exists and still thrives here in Bristol to this day, owns a fantastic amount of land, and I'm afraid to say our mayor of the city, who was elected last year, is actually a merchant venturer himself. I mean, he certainly seems to be quite a friendly guy, but they have a tremendous power still, George, in this country, and I think what's going on is a kind of financial slavery by these people. And this is one of the reasons why Gambia left the Commonwealth, is because they're looking at Britain now and saying, well, you used to go and take over these countries with your soldiers. Now you're using the IMF, you're using finance in order to do it. And actually what's going on is exactly the same. You're doing things like flooding the markets with cheap food until our farmers go out of business, and then you're putting the prices of the food up. These are the same exact techniques that we used hundreds of years ago here in Britain to fix food prices, the sort of things that led to the beginning of the English Civil War against unfair taxes. And so we have an elite ruling class who don't ever like to be seen on the television or on the radio or appear in the newspaper, but they like to control things from behind the scenes. And there's only so long that can actually go on before you have some kind of, civil war, a bit like we've seen in Syria, possibly even here in Britain and possibly in the United States, although I think because of the gun laws over there, it would be particularly nasty in America if it were to happen, George.
Right. We see a consolidation of capital, like the British East India Company was one, and then the Merchant Ventures or Adventurers was another one. And also another one was the Inquisition period, that the Catholic Church consolidated much wealth and capital through land. Would you say that was a great capital consolidation for the Church?
Well, yes, definitely. But you see, the thing is with the Church, at least the Church has got some kind of duty to be sharing that wealth with the poor. I don't think that there's any, that certainly has happened in the past, but there seems to be more and more emphasis on governments that we've got nowadays, certainly here, is spending money on prestige projects and less, and they seem to really resent spending money on the poor. But let's not forget, the actual benefits, social security benefits, welfare benefits that are dished out to people are actually compensation for stolen land. That's what they are. And whether people want to recognise that or not is up to them. And, of course, people may have to go and take their land back. They may have to actually go and squat buildings, which is one of the things that's happening here in Britain, although the laws have just changed on that and they're trying to stop squatters. People need somewhere to live. Right. And, you really can't take their land away from them. People are actually incredibly resourceful, George. If people are given somewhere to live, given a workshop to work in, given a bit of space where they don't have to pay any rent, you will find that they are incredibly resourceful. The idea that they sit around on their hands doing nothing is complete nonsense. If people are given the opportunity, they will get together with others, they will make things, they will design things, they will contribute to their local society, the local community. And I think that's the sort of society I'd like to see in the future, where more people are actually given space to live around them. They don't have to pay rent. They don't need money. And that people can then start to freely associate with each other to do the things they want to do. We had a survey here last month, maybe 2 months ago, by Office Angels, the employment agency, that said that over half of the people who are in employment in Britain want to change their job. They've had enough of the job that they're doing. Now, that is not satisfaction. Capitalism is not delivering satisfaction for people. If they're going to work every day doing something they don't want to do, then we need to change this system. We've got to change it fast, and we've got to do something about it, because it's starting to turn into a form of coercive slavery where money is our master and it's not our servant anymore. And so, you know, we are going to it's going to have to change one way or another, whether it's by a nice democratic means or whether it's by some sort of upheaval, social upheaval, I really don't know. But somehow we've got to change this, George.
You know, there was a recent book issued by Project Center out of California. Peter Phillips, I think, heads it up. And in their survey, they name about the top 13 financial companies and trading companies in the world, and Barclays was number one. That surprised me with some of the problems that they've had in the past. Would that be an accurate assessment?
Quite possibly, but I mean, the Barclays haven't had any problems, George. They are running the world. I mean, they had something called the LIBOR scandal, which they seem to have got off from virtually scot-free. I had a look at the fine. They got fined a piffling amount, tiny amount of money, and it was something like 2 weeks' profits from 5 years of their fraud. So actually what they're saying by a silly little fine like that is just carry on, guys, you know, no problem at all. And all they got was the profits of 2 weeks of fraud as a fine. And that was the company that got fined. None of the individuals actually got fined.
Do you see what's being set up is that the really big dogs in the financial sector, they're getting as liquid as they can to take over and just eat up and gobble up those less liquid, weaker financial organizations. They're
absolutely.
Getting ready.
There's a financial takeover. There is no rule of law.
Yeah.
There's no rule of law. We've got, all these crimes being perpetrated by these massive organizations. And I'm afraid the police and the rest are just looking the other way. Okay, guys, that's a bit embarrassing, isn't it? And then they'll go and arrest somebody for stealing a bottle of water and put them in jail for 4 months. You know, this is just, the society's breaking down, George, I'm afraid, you know. I mean, some parts of it seem to be working reasonably well, just about, but overall, there is a massive corrosion of all of the, basic important parts
of our society. This Obamacare they're rolling out on October 1, they paid $634 million to have the computer program put together. The site to take in all this, it's not even working. That is a horrendously rip-off price. What do you think?
Yeah, but that doesn't mean to say Obamacare is not a fantastic idea. I mean, that's what a government should be doing. It should be caring for the health of its people. I mean, you know, we've had this thing ever since the end of the Second World War called the National Health Service in Britain, which is, it's having a bit of a bumpy ride over the last few years, but it's been a brilliant, fantastic organisation. I mean, what it's saying essentially is that your government will make sure that you're okay health-wise, and you will not have to pay for a doctor at any time in your life at all. Now, that is a brilliant thing for any government to do.
Well, the thing is that I would differ a little bit with you on that, Tony, here, because this is the first time where this is a mandatory type of registration system of every American. And just like you were talking about those biometrics in your school system back there, this is putting everyone under the thumb of the federal government in this country, and that alone would be enough for me to be against it.
Well, I don't think so. I completely disagree. I mean, I know there's a lot of people over there that don't like Obamacare, but listen, all we've got here is something called a National Health Service number, which is some sort of 8-digit code. So, what they do is they just have a look over the large number of years at what your health, you know, what various treatments that you've had. It's nothing more than, there's nothing more sinister than that. There's no digital chips involved, there's no fingerprints, nothing else. It's just so that your doctor can see, well, this person has had this treatment at this time, that treatment at that time, and that treatment can then be tracked by your doctor, not by anybody else, but only by healthcare professionals.
In this country, we've had that preceded this financial intrusive bills that were passed through Congress that allow the federal government to look at each and every bank account of every citizen in this country. That, coupled with this medical stuff, is going way, way too
well, yeah, but you don't need to have all that financial intrusion at the medical system.
Yeah, nothing is free. It costs somebody something. It's going to be a high tax burden then on the people.